WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Edward Villella is considered one of the greatest male dancers in the history of American ballet. He began studying at the School of American Ballet at 10, and in his teens he caught the eye of master choreographer George Balanchine. That began a stormy and creative 30-year relationship between the two men. Villella was one of Balanchine's principal dancers at the New York City Ballet. He's written a memoir about his life as a dancer and his relationship with Balanchine called Prodigal Son. He described himself as a reluctant, even unlikely dancer. He was an athletic street kid. He boxed. He played baseball. He was dragged to ballet school to get him off the streets and forced to take classes after he became so disruptive. Villella tried to disguise this fact from his friends in his blue-collar New York neighborhood by wearing his baseball uniform to classes. Villella was the first male dancer to bring a physicality to ballet. He was known for jumps and leaps. I asked him if his attraction to the physical potential of dance was there from the start.
That is totally what captivated me. I was not involved in the aesthetics, nor did I even ever see a ballet in my life. But the actual physical activity was what captivated me. I would ignore the music. I was totally off the music, around it, nowhere near it. It didn't matter to me, but what mattered was the physical action itself. It was only later, when I began to have a deeper understanding of what this stuff was all about, that I connected all of those things.
When you're talking about the physicality, is that the leaping through the air, or was it the pliés and everything else?
I was not interested in the finesse of it. I was interested in the acrobatic aspects of it. I was interested in the physical challenges, the feats, the tricks in the air, the beating of the feet high above the floor, the turning in the air two and three times. Those were the things that motivated me and captivated me, simply because those were things that I had a natural ability for. I did not have a natural inclination or ability for the finesse, the quality, the foundation, the internal structure of all of this. Most people gain the internal structure and then work for the hard tricks. I had the hard tricks and felt that I didn't need the infrastructure, but that is the support upon which we are able to proceed. So it took me a long, long time before I got sense enough, got wise enough, was informed enough to realize that I needed all of it.
Why was your love of ballet such an affront to your parents?
Well, I came from a second-generation, first-generation American, Italian-American family. We were a blue-collar family. We lived in a blue-collar area of Queens. So we didn't have aesthetic pursuits as our main motivation. It was not part of our world, not part of our circle. So especially in the mid-40s, we didn't have a long tradition for classical dance in America. We didn't have an abundance of schools, theaters, companies, directors, teachers. We didn't have the external as well as internal structures to do such things.
Was it the concern that many parents have, which is literally their children cannot support themselves? They saw this as a job that wouldn't pay the bills?
Well, in those days, of course, as I said, we didn't have an abundance of companies, so it was a precarious occupation. When I first joined the New York City Ballet as late as 1957, that company was only working 5 or 6 months a year. So there wasn't a seemingly secure future for all of this. And certainly in terms of myself, as a young boy, my father was somewhat mortified that his son was in a suspect area, a suspect in terms of one's sexual preferences. My father's personal friends were two former professional prize fighters, so he couldn't understand the aesthetic pursuits that I was involved in, nor could he stand the apparent embarrassment that went along with it. So I had an awful lot of opposition going into this stuff.
I'm speaking with Edward Villella, and he's considered one of America's most celebrated male dancers, and he's just written a book about his life called Prodigal Son. You describe Balanchine, George Balanchine's relationship with his female dancers as rather complicated, rather involved relationships, very flirtatious. How would you say he treated his male dancers?
Well, Balanchine, first of all, would say to all of us that ballet is woman. He said to me way back in the late 50s that in sports, it was Mickey Mantle. In politics, it was Eisenhower. In ballet, it was woman. So needless to say, that got my attention. But one could understand Balanchine if you stop and analyze. I mean, he was fond of saying that women were so much more interesting to choreograph for because they had a number of things. They had an additional level upon which they danced. Male dancers dance on the flat foot and the half toe. Women dance on those two levels, but also on the full point. He also suggested that women had a far more flexible muscle tone, were therefore able to do certain gestures in a more expanded manner and fashion. In addition to that, partnering was developed whereby men would lift and support women, giving another choreographic possibility. So his fascination was that, along with the fact that he simply adored women, and they were the muses in his life. He was in love with these people that he choreographed for. He had formal relationships with five people, marriages, etc. You can look back at the New York City Ballet, and you can see the specific periods of the ballerinas that he adored. You look back at the Maria Tallchief period in the repertoire, you can recognize that, the Tanaquille LeClaire, the Allegra Kent, the Suzanne Farrell, etc. So he was a man who was motivated and moved by women. But by the same token, he made probably the single greatest repertoire for male dancers. So there's something of a dichotomy in all of it. But there is no question that the man was motivated by women.
Why was it so important for you to try to prove yourself to him? You call him your artistic father.
Because George Balanchine had all of the knowledge. He was the giver not only of knowledge, but he was the giver of repertoire. He was the worker of masterwork. He could mold masterwork on your own body, and he did it so wonderfully and so specifically for you as an individual. Even though he proclaimed that this was a no-star system, we were listed alphabetically, he would make a work for you, you would dance it, and the next morning you were a star. So again, there were contradictions all the time. Plus, he was a very, very abstract individual. He spoke in abstracts, but if you understood what he was abstracting from, it gave you great insight into the man.
You say he was a quick studier, or he worked rather quickly, and he would say, "Don't talk, just do."
He, I believe, felt that what his understanding was enough. He didn't need your further understanding. What he would do to the music in relation to the style, the period, the points of departure, the internetworkings choreographically was enough. He didn't need further comment on what he had already covered. I think that he believed that we were simply tools. We were certainly the raw material, but we didn't need to make comment beyond his comment. I had a different point of view. My point of view was I needed to know why he said those things, what was behind it, what was inside this. I needed to know the inner content. Therefore, if I digested this well enough, what would then come out of my body was a total, complete understanding. I think I have an understanding of why he didn't want us to do too much of that, because the natural inclination in human beings is to go a little bit too far with this stuff, to start chewing up the scenery, eating up the scenery, to overact, to overstate, to overdance. There's a very, very fine line. It takes a great deal of experience and investigation not to overly adorn a gesture, simply to leave it simple, to walk away with simplicity, to leave simply the essence, not the overstatement of a moment or a gesture.
How much did you have to dance through pain? And it seems whenever someone does an interview with a ballet dancer, half of the interview has to do with dancing through pain. How did you deal with it?
Well, pain became a shadow. Pain became almost a friend. Hmm. It certainly was, it went beyond enemy and got closer to being an acquaintance and almost a friend, because it was with you constantly. I very foolishly, when I first returned to dance, enjoyed the pain because I had this foolish notion that if I ache, I must have used my muscles well and worked them real hard. So if you work real hard, you hurt. So I had this crazy, foolish notion that was right. Now, of course, we have different views of this sort of stuff, and we are prepared, and we have within our facilities dance trainers and dance medicine and masseurs and orthopedic surgeons and all of those other things. In those days at the New York City Ballet, Balanchine wouldn't even allow a masseur into the theater. He simply didn't believe in it. So we had tremendous disadvantages. And yes, pain will be part of anybody's physical activity when they overdo. And dancers have a natural inclination to overdo. It takes a great deal of background and knowledge to know just what is enough. That is great art. When you do just enough, not too much and not too little, the inclination again is to do too much.
Well, it was injuries really that forced you out of performing ballet. What was it like for you to not dance? And you describe in your book the difficulty of cooling down after a performance, the transition from one performance to the next. How did you handle not dancing?
It was very, very difficult. I said to myself when I first joined the New York City Ballet on my 21st birthday, what a wonderful beginning, but it is indeed the beginning of the end, and I should prepare for the end. Now, that I don't wish to suggest that I was being very pessimistic. I was trying to be realistic, and I was trying to say to myself that in 20 years' time, I should have, over those years, had the best of a career that I possibly could have, but also prepare myself to walk away sensibly, logically, and practically. That never happened, and what occurred to me was I had a performance at the White House during the Ford administration, and I danced the Corsair Pas de Deux, and I had a tremendous pain in my leg. I danced with Mrs. Ford at the reception afterwards, went back to New York the next morning, and found out that my hip had given way, that I had worn out all of the cartilage in my hip socket. So one night I was dancing at the White House and I was a dancer of the world. And the next day I was not only a pedestrian, but I was a pedestrian who couldn't walk. So it was an incredible shock. It was a tremendous humiliation for me because I had lost my physicality. I had not only lost my physicality, I had lost the love and the passion of my life. But I had also lost basically my identity. And because, again, we get so captured by this stuff, we get totally enraptured with it, it becomes us. We live this world. I spent about 6 months being very, very down, and I will admit only now that I was probably deeply depressed. It took me about a year before I could go back and look at the roles that I had previously danced.
You couldn't admit that back then, how deeply depressed you felt?
No. And I think I did that subconsciously to protect myself from giving in to that depression. I think what I was doing was basically fighting that depression.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Edward Villela, and he's one of America's most celebrated dancers, and he was a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. He's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet and has just written a book about his life called The Prodigal Son. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with dancer Edward Villela. You're now the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which you founded. How would you compare your style of working with your dancers to Balanchine's style?
Well, I owe a debt to Balanchine. What I learned from him, I certainly use in terms of principle and understanding and information. What I don't do is imitate Balanchine. I think imitation is practically death. I think it's still breathing, but it's basically moribund. Why imitate? I think times change, circumstances change, people change, countries change, and why should not approach to even major classical form change, even though that original approach came from a genius, the level of a Balanchine? What I did was I took all of my experience, I digested it, and then applied it as it fit contemporary circumstance and situation. So what I like to think is I was guided by my past, my background, by people such as Balanchine and Williams, but it is time now to make my own statement in my own time. This is my time now to be a director. It is decades after when I was learning about this stuff.
Well, let me read something that you said in a New Yorker profile a couple of years ago, and you said the whole art form is based on paradoxes. Your landing is your takeoff. You go down to go up. The fastest preparation is the fullest through the whole foot. You still believe that?
Absolutely. I believe that more now than ever. And those are the conclusions that I came to from these great people, from a person such as Balanchine and a person such as Stanley Williams. In these investigations, I found that really what we are about movement. That's all we are. However, we have taken normal, everyday human movement, and we have formed it, and we formed it by the positions that come out of our technical stuff. So that when we look at it simply as pose, you begin to land. You begin to squeeze out a landing. Now you have an ending. But a variation should never end. A gesture never ends. When we stand on stage, we are moving. It is a never-ending sense of gesture, even, again, if you're standing still. So it makes logic and sense to me that when you land from a jump, the moment you get to the bottom of the jump, which to me is when the heel finally hits that stage or floor, it's time then to push up. So you don't think down in the preparation. You think you pass through down and go to the next place. So you pass through down to go up. It's full, again, of those kinds of paradoxes. For instance, we have something called turnout. We turn out our feet, but we turn out our entire body. So think in these terms. If you are making a pirouette, a turn to the right, but you are turning out your whole body, you are turning the left side of your body to the left, the right side of your body to the right, and yet the whole body goes around to the right. So again, you've got these dichotomies, and you've got to have this internal understanding, this approach to this stuff, so you don't stilt or stop gesture. You have to continue the line of movement.
You write in the end of your book that ballet is an art form that has lost its conscience. What do you mean?
Well, I think George Balanchine was indeed the conscience of the entire dance world. He was a man without flamboyant pretensions and overly adorned and all of those things. He was a man not given to great personal comforts. He didn't have limousines and chauffeurs and servants and those things. He was a man who worked. And not only that, he had a wonderful sense of integrity about the art form. He was a great entertainer, but he did it qualitatively. And so just in terms of the approach to the aesthetics of the art form, there's been no one like him before or since. And again, I think the way he presented new work just showed us new ways. He was constantly stimulating, constantly allowing us insight into the possibilities that were available. He simply illuminated the inside of the art form without, again, pretension. He was devoted to the art itself and not to the trappings that go along with it.
You describe George Balanchine as your artistic father, a man you tried very hard to please. What was your relationship like with your own father, and how different was it from your relationship with Balanchine?
I had a lot of similarities in both relationships. My father was a wonderful man. He was gentle and he was generous and he was sensitive, but he drove a truck. He was a man who was involved in far more basic pursuits in life, and at one point, when my sister stopped dancing, my father said, okay, that's it. Enough of this frivolity, and especially for you, meaning me. And he said, from now on, we're going to drop this thing called ballet, and you're going to concentrate on going to college. And I was sent to a military school. And when I finished that degree, I had sneaked back the last year and started taking some classes, presented myself to Balanchine, and was offered a job. When I told him I was taking a job at the New York City Ballet, he stopped talking to me for over a year.
Really?
And it wasn't until I sent both he and my mother tickets to our second opening night a year after I had joined the New York City Ballet. And I suggested to them that if they enjoyed the performance, they could come backstage afterwards. And my father was reluctant to come, and I thought, well, maybe they wouldn't come back anyway. However, there were four ballets on that evening. Of the four ballets, I had four principal roles, and I'm sure my parents were expecting me to be lost somewhere in the back of the corps de ballet. And I guess they were somewhat stunned, if not impressed. At any rate, the evening ended, and the final curtain came down, and I was standing on the stage huffing and puffing and pouring sweat with my makeup pouring down and my wet costume. And Balanchine came on stage and started telling me what I'd been doing right and wrong, and we continued this very physical conversation. The curtain went up. It was a dark house. The stagehand came, put the nightlight on the stage, left. Balanchine and I continued our conversation. We finished. Shook hands, bowed to each other. Balanchine went off stage right. I started to go off stage left towards my dressing room, and I saw something and heard something in the wing. And there were standing my mother and father in tears. And the three of us stood on that stage laughing and hugging and crying. And from that time on, my father became a balletomane and handed out my reviews and pictures in the garment center. So there was a lovely kind of resolution to that conflict, and now I had what it was that I wanted, along with parental approval.
Edward Villela, I thank you so much for joining us today. I really do appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Edward Villela is now the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which he founded a few years ago. His book is called Prodigal Son. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.